Richard just mentioned these two books, which came out in Terror and Territory came out in 2009 and Birth of Territory in 2013. The book I'm going to talk about today builds on some of the arguments that are in those books, but in quite a different register, because it's a book about Shakespeare rather than about either contemporary politics at the time in Terror and Territory or the history of the concept of territory and the birth of territory. But what I try and make the argument is, you know, this question of kind of why should geographers, particularly I think political geographers, be interested in Shakespeare, other than that Shakespeare is kind of interesting in his own right. Well, what I'd suggest is that Shakespeare actually really helps us to think about the question of territory. Now, it's long been known that you can read Shakespeare politically. If you read the famous tragedies, there's issues about power and legitimacy, for example, in Hamlet and Macbeth. There's questions about the use and abuse of authority in Measure for Measure, legal financial questions in Merchant of Venice, race and colonialism in Othello and the Tempest, the history plays, particularly the English history plays, that trace a long line of kings from Richard II through to Henry VI, tell us a lot about the time that the plays were written, as much as they tell us about the history that they're actually talking about. And even some of Shakespeare's lesser-known plays, so Timon of Athens, for example, is Karl Marx's most frequent reference, because Timon of Athens has a lot of stuff about money and money lending in it. Now, in the past few decades, there's been a discussion of some of the geographical aspects of Shakespeare's plays. So the two books on the left there, John Gillies' Shakespeare and the Geography of Difference and Garrett Sullivan's The Drama of Landscape, two books that came out in the 1990s, were really, I think, fundamental in setting an agenda for how Shakespeare's plays might be read and engaged with from a geographical perspective. And then two more recent books, Kristen Paul's Supernatural Environments in Shakespeare's England and Steve Mentz's At the Bottom of Shakespeare's Ocean, which reads Shakespeare kind of as a sort of an oceanography rather than just a geography. And there's a number of other studies that I've made use of in my work here about themes around exile, borders, national geographies, exploration, environment, and so on. There's a lot of literature on what we might call kind of spatial practices, cartography, surveying, geometry, navigation. And there's literature about the spatiality of the stage, how you physically organise the space of the stage and the sort of the geographies of performance there. Now, my focus has been on territory, which is obviously a political and a geographical concept. And so I try and bring the literature on Shakespeare read politically and his contributions to political theory along with this literature on geography. And I think that territory is an important concept in a number of Shakespeare's plays. And the literature on geography in Shakespeare has sort of touched on this, but it hasn't really had it centre stage as a focus. And that's what I try and do in this book, is to try and work through these things. Now, I said it builds on the argument of the previous two books, in that one of the things that I've suggested about territory is that territory is a complicated concept as well as something that is always complicated in practice. And I think that a lot of political geography and international relations and so on has tended to think territory is a relatively straightforward concept, but it's always very complicated in practice, where you actually draw a boundary, who actually rules, how you divide up lands, and so on. What I've tried to do in those previous two books is to say, actually, territory is certainly complicated in practice, but it's also complicated conceptually, and it needs the same kind of work that justice, rights, sovereignty, pick other political concepts. It needs the same kind of conceptual work as looking at how it actually works out in practice. So what I've tried to suggest in those previous works, and I build on in Shakespearean territories, is that the standard definition that you often get of territory, the sort of dictionary definition or the beginning of a political geography textbook, a territory is a bounded space under the control of a group of people. Like, well, yeah, it might take that form at some times, but that doesn't exhaust all of the complexities of the notion of territory. For me, territory, there's a whole range of different practices and understandings that need to be thought through. Practices and techniques like bordering, dividing, conquering, excluding, enclosing, controlling, surveying, mapping, all of these different types of practices and understandings that underpin the way that we should think about territory. So territory is certainly a political and a geographical concept, but for me there's a whole set of processes going on, economic, strategic, legal, technical, and so on, and that we need to think about all of those in order to really understand the complexity of territory, not as a way of coming up with a single better definition of territory, but to understand the sorts of questions that we need to ask it to understand territory in different times and in different places. And it seems to me that Shakespeare illustrates a number of those different aspects in his plays. So it's a book that's both about Shakespeare for a geography audience, kind of like you, but I'm hoping it's also a book about territory for a Shakespeare audience, that I'm hoping that, that Shakespeare scholars, English language departments and so on will find something interesting in the book, in that I'm taking a different lens as a way of reading some of Shakespeare's plays. And I try and keep that balance between a book about Shakespeare and a book about territory for those different audiences as I go through the work. And more broadly, I think that the question of territory is a way of understanding the relation between people, power and place. That sort of grouping of people, where they're located and the relations of power, the governed, the governing, the regulation and the rule, the power relations and so on. So Shakespeare's born in 1564 in the reign of Queen Elizabeth. And if you look at the political theory of the time, 1560s, almost no political theory in English uses the word territory. It talks about relations, but it uses a different vocabulary to think about it. And even Latin texts, and Latin was still the language that many people wrote in at the time, because then, whether they were English, French, German, Italian, or whatever, they could all read Latin. Even the Latin texts of the 1560s, when they use the term territorium, the Latin word, they tend to mean something a little bit different from the way that we understand the term today. By the time Shakespeare dies in 1616, beginning of the 17th century, the term has become much more common in debates in political theory and political practice. Jean Bodin, a French political theorist who wrote a book called The Six Books of the Commonwealth, he writes it first in French in 1576 and then doesn't quite translate it, but sort of rewrites it in Latin in 1586. The term is all over that work. You can find it in an English theologian's work, The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity, Richard Hooker's book, which is a book that's trying to make sense of the relation that England now has, now that the Church of England has been established and the break from Rome, the break from the Catholic Church has happened. How do you govern both theologically and politically within this kingdom? You can find the term territorium in a lot of the Latin texts from this period, particularly by German writers who are trying to work out the relation that the different bits of the Holy Roman Empire have to the emperor and to the pope. So people like Andreas Knicken and Johannes Althusius use the term territorium much more frequently then. And Shakespeare dies in 1616, which is just 2 years before the 30 Years' War breaks out in continental Europe. And part of the reason behind that war, the 30 Years' War, was the very struggle that the German writers, Knicken, Althusius and others, were dealing with, of what's the relation to of a free city or the Kingdom of Bavaria or a principality to the overarching empire? What relation of political rule do they have, and what reference do they have to the Pope? Now, the 30 Years' War comes to an end in 1648 with peace treaties that you've probably heard of, even if you don't know anything about the 30 Years' War, which is the Westphalia treaties, the Peace of Westphalia, or the two treaties of Westphalia. And often in international relations, Westphalia is seen as this kind of founding moment of the international system. People talk about the Westphalian system or the Westphalian state or Westphalian sovereignty. Now, frankly, there's a lot of rubbish written about Westphalia by people who've never actually read the treaties. They say almost nothing that people think they do. They're a much more specific focus of how do you regulate relations within the empire rather than a European-wide kind of peace settlement. But what they do is a sort of a setup. The Westphalia treaties raise a number of questions that political theory after them is trying to resolve. So a number of thinkers, some of whom I hope will be familiar to you, but Thomas Hobbes, Philipp von Chemnitz, Samuel Pufendorf, especially Gottfried Leibniz, they're all kind of working in the wake of the Westphalia treaties. And Leibniz in particular is asked by the Duke of Hanover, who employs him as the court historian. Duke of Hanover says to Leibniz, well, what rights do I have as a ruler in relation to the empire? And Leibniz, he takes about 200-300 pages to get to this point, but he eventually comes up with a really short, sharp, and quite modern definition. The sovereign or potentate is that lord or state who is master of a territory, and that it's the relation of political power to territory that defines the type of rule that the Duke of Hanover actually has. So what I'm trying to suggest by that very, very compressed history, which is dealt with much more detail in The Birth of Territory, is that Shakespeare's writing at an interesting moment. Late 16th, early 17th century. It's a time when the word territory becomes much more common in peace treaties, in political theory texts, in the wider debates about government, and that the concept and practice of territory is increasingly being theorised, it's being practised. States are trying to consolidate the territory they already have. They're starting to claim territories overseas through colonial projects. And so Shakespeare's writing, I think, at an interesting moment in when there's a shift around the way that we might understand these. And so this is why I suggest territory is a theme that we can find in a number of Shakespeare's plays and that we can unpick and think about territory, hopefully in an interesting way, through those plays. And yet Shakespeare actually doesn't use the word territory very often. It actually only appears in two plays. The word territory, singular, appears in As You Like It and in the folio text of King Lear. The word territories appears in a handful of plays, but it's still a relatively uncommon word in Shakespeare. But I think that a number of Shakespeare's plays, and I'll try and show this with a few examples, talk about territory even when they don't use the word. They're thinking about the practice or the concept of territory. His plays are interested in issues around banishment, exile, spatial division, succession, who rules, how you regulate the rule over a particular place, and so on. And so the concept and practice, I don't think, is unusual in his work, even though the word is fairly marginal. So this is what I try and do in the book, and I'll say a few words about each chapter, but I'll focus on a couple of them and give you some examples from some plays. So the book begins with two chapters that treat fairly well-known tragedies. I begin with King Lear. King Lear has an opening scene where the king is deciding about how he's going to prepare for rule after his death. He's going to give his three daughters and their husbands portions of his kingdom. So he has a moment when he says, I have a map and I'm going to divide up the kingdom into shares between my three daughters. And this is the one place where Shakespeare really uses the term territory in a particular way. He says, I'm going to divest myself of rule, interest of territory, cares of state. I'm going to divide this up between my daughters. And I read King Lear through what I call the geopolitics, the territory, the land, and the earth, and how these work through the play. Now, this was the first thing I wrote about Shakespeare. I published it as a journal article in 2013, and it was really the sort of the beginning of this overall project to think about how territory figures in that play, and then beginning to think, well, maybe I could do some other plays and I could build up a bigger argument out of that. Second chapter then turns to Hamlet and Macbeth, and I try and read those plays by suggesting that while the standard focus of the way that we look at those plays is about the relation between Hamlet, his uncle Claudius, his murdered father, his mother Gertrude, who used to be married to his father and now is married to his uncle, and we tend to look at it through the family relations and the court politics of Hamlet. In Macbeth, we tend to think about it as Macbeth has murdered the king and has become the king in his place, and then he too gets overthrown by the murdered king's son. We tend to look at the family relations and the court politics of those plays. What I try and do is sort of zoom out and to look at the regional geopolitics, the relation that those two kingdoms have to their neighbours. So with Hamlet, I look at the relations between Denmark, where all the action takes place, but also the relations that Denmark has to Norway, to Poland, and then more peripherally to England and to France. In Macbeth, I try and look at the relation that Scotland has to Norway, which is fighting a war with Scotland at the very beginning of the play, but also the relation that Scotland has to England and to Ireland. And so I try and read those plays in a sort of a regional sense of what we would now call the international relations of those kingdoms, but to try and suggest that we can read those plays through a wider setting rather than just the individual action. Hamlet is the one I'm going to say a little bit more about. Hamlet, I think, is interesting here, partly because in the opening scene of Hamlet, a long and, I think, wide backstory, a sort of long historical and a wide geographically backstory is set out before we actually meet Hamlet or the new king, Claudius, or his mother, or any of those figures. We have a history and a geography that's told about the setting of the kingdom. So, in the opening scene, the night watch, this is the guards up on the battlements, encounter a ghostly figure. And so the name is What art thou that usurps this time of night, together with that fair and warlike form in which the majesty of buried Denmark did sometimes march? So they're encountering a figure who looks like Denmark, and Denmark here is not just the country, it's the king. So this ghost looks like the murdered king Hamlet. So who are they? What's happening in this setting? Horatio, who's one of the members of the Night Watch, goes on to note the visual resemblance that this ghostly figure has to the king in his glory days. Such was the very armour he had on when he, the ambitious Norway, combated. So frowned he once when in an angry parle he smote the sledded Polacks on the ice. Now, there's some complexities just in those four lines about what is actually meant by that. Norway here means the king of Norway, rather than just, again, the country. And the king of Norway was called Fortinbra. And those opening two lines of that four-line passage suggest that this ghostly figure looks like the king back in his glory days when he had a hand-to-hand combat with the king of Norway. The complexity comes in whether the second pair of lines there continue that same story or whether they talk about a different encounter. And the beginning of the second line and the middle of the third line give an indication. When followed by once seems to suggest two separate encounters. If it had said when and then it would seem to suggest a single encounter. But the real complexity comes from what is meant by the sledded Polacks. Sledded Polacks is what you find in most modern editions of the play, spelt in those two words in that way. But it's actually an editor's emendation of what it actually says in the two or the three texts we have of Hamlet. This is because the play was printed at different times by different rival publishers, and there's substantial differences in the different versions of Hamlet. So the first and second quarto, which is a small sort of pocket edition of the play, has sledded with an A, Polacks ending in an X. And then the folio has sledded double D in there. So does this mean a sledded Polacks, a weapon, or sledded Polacks people? And this is a big debate in the play about what actually might be meant by this. The one time that Shakespeare uses Polacks, a weapon, I'll explain what the weapon is in a moment, in another play he spells it the same as here. So a Polacks is like a long axe on the end of a staff, like a halberd. So it would be a long kind of pole-type weapon that would have an axe end on it and it would have a point at the top. And it might have a weight as a counterbalance or a hammer on the other side to the axe so that it didn't topple too much. And this would be like a pike weapon that soldiers would set and that would defend against a cavalry charge. So if it's a sledded poleaxe, then you can imagine that King Hamlet has smashed this weapon onto the ice. So he frowned once when in an angry parle he smote the sledded poleaxe on the ice. He smashes this weapon into the ice. Norway, Denmark, it's an icy area. You can imagine this might have happened. Sledded in that sense would mean something like a sledgehammer, leaded or weighted, studded, some kind of weapon type. If you read it in the other way, sledded Polacks, Polish soldiers on sledges on the ice. And Polack today has a sort of derogatory sense, particularly in North America. It's an offensive word to use of somebody of Polish ancestry. At the time, it meant the same as a Pole, somebody from Poland. So you have in those few lines either one encounter with the King of Norway and the weapon that he used, or you have two encounters, one with Norway and one with Poland. And it seems to me that the Polish one makes more sense, because later in the play, you have a rivalry between Norway and Poland as the two major regional powers in relation to a much smaller kingdom of Denmark. But it's one of the uncertainties that textual questions raise about what kinds of issues there might be in the play. Now, we hear a lot more about the encounter with Norway. We don't hear so much about Poland in the play, although it does feature at certain moments. But what's interesting, I think, in following this speech that Horatio says when he's talking about this ghostly figure they've seen on the battlements, is that he then outlines this much more detailed story to explain who the ghostly figure might be and why, at this present moment, they have a night watch up on the battlements to try to secure and fortify Denmark. They also talk about brass cannon being struck, about the shipyards working overtime in order to prepare military preparations and so on. So the other figures of the watch ask Horatio if he can explain actually what's going on. "That can I," he says. I'll read the whole speech, which is quite long, and then I'll come back and try and explain what I think's happening in it. "That can I, at least the whisper goes so. Our last king, whose image even but now appeared to us, was, as you know, by Fortinbras of Norway, thereto pricked on by a most emulate pride, dead to the combat in which our valiant Hamlet, for those so this side of the world, known world esteemed him, did slay this Fortinbras, who by a sealed compact, well ratified by law and heraldry, did forfeit with his life all these his lands, which he should seized of to the conqueror, against the which a moiety competent was gauged by our king, which had returned to the inheritance of Fortinbras, had he been vanquisher, as by the same co-martin carriage of the article design, his fell to Hamlet. Now, sir, young Fortinbras, of unimproved metal, hot and full, hath in the skirts of Norway here and there sharked up a list of lawless resolutes, for food and diet to some enterprise that hath a stomach in it, which is no other, as it doth well appear into the state, but to recover of us by strong hand and terms compulsatory those foresaid lands so by his father lost. And this, I take it, is the main motive of our preparations, the source of this our watch, and the chief head of this post-haste and rummage in the land." All right, so it's a long quote, but it's actually a very compressed narrative of what's actually happened some years before. Let me try and explain what I think is going on in this. Horatio knows this story, but he calls it a whisper, so a rumour or a secret. Hamlet, King Hamlet, this is the title character of the play's father, killed King Fortinbras of Norway after being provoked into combat through their jealous rivalry. And Hamlet, King Hamlet, was known across the Western Hemisphere for his own valour. Now, quite how Horatio knows what the king was wearing 20, 30 years before is unclear. We hear that he's actually a fellow student of Hamlet, so it doesn't quite make sense how he would have known about this combat and exactly what he was wearing at the time and so on. But by the death, between this duel between these two kings, King Fortinbras of Norway forfeited lands to Hamlet, which was an agreement that was legally sworn and in accordance with the rules of chivalry. The lands that were given as a result of this death in combat passed then not to his son Fortinbras by inheritance, but to King Hamlet by conquest. They were seized, that is taken, but seized also has a legal meaning in terms of possession of land. Were these his personal lands or part of the kingdom? Well, that's unclear, but it was clearly not the entirety of the Kingdom of Norway, because the next line shows that there were an equivalent portion of lands would have been forfeited by Hamlet had he fallen in this duel between the two kings. So had Hamlet been killed, then the lands of Denmark would have gone to Fortinbras, but Fortinbras was killed by Hamlet, and so therefore the lands came to Denmark. Now, young Fortinbras, this is the dead king's son, refuses to accept this state of affairs. We're now onto this part of the passage. And this encounter happened on the day of Hamlet, the main character of the play's birth. So this is 20, 30 years before, depending on his age. Now, Fortinbras, so the son of the dead king of Norway, has, with a wish to prove himself, roused up in the borderlands, the outskirts of Norway, a group of men to form an army to try and get these lands back. And who are these men? Well, the first and second quarto call them lawless, as I've got up on the screen. But lawless in the folio is actually replaced by landless. So there's a debate about whether they're lawless or landless. Landless in some senses seems to make sense. People that had been disinherited of their lands, or younger sons who had never inherited, would form a more organised army than lawless resolutes. But clearly they are trying to form an army to take back these lands that were lost a generation before. Fortinbras, in French, Fortinbras basically means strong in hand, strong in arm rather. Here is by strong hand seeking to get those lands back. And so because of that threat that young Fortinbras of Norway is posing to Denmark, this is why, what it calls here, the post-haste and rummage in the land, this is why there's a night watch up on the battlements keeping guard, this is why there are the military preparations. Denmark is preparing for a war against Norway. And I'm not going to go through the whole play to work through these things, but this Fortinbras story, this Norway threat of invasion, is something that keeps coming back through the play. Claudius tries to send off people to buy off the King of Norway to prevent him from his nephew from taking over Denmark. They try and pay him off with an annual allowance. They allow him passage through Denmark to attack Poland. This is where Poland comes back into the play. So there's a whole set of sort of things going on in the background through the play of this rivalry between Norway, Poland and Denmark. And Hamlet actually encounters Fortinbras' army when they're on their way to Poland at a later stage in the play. Hamlet is being sent off into exile into England, and he encounters this Norwegian army preparing for a war against Poland. And then right at the end of the play, and for those of you that know the play, basically every major character dies in the very last scene of the play. And right at the end of the play, Fortinbras sort of walks onto the stage. I have some memory of interest in this land, and he reclaims the lands that his father had lost, because he's the only person standing that has any claim to the Kingdom of Denmark. So Fortinbras kind of encircles the play. He's there as this threat at the beginning of the play, and he walks on stage right at the end of the play to retake those lands. He's caused the reason for why they have the threat at the beginning. He's the person who inherits at the end. And the threat of one invasion and the military conquest right at the end, Denmark actually, through the death of Claudius and Gertrude and Hamlet and Ophelia and how many others die, Laertes, all of the people that might have a claim die. Fortinbras takes the lands of Denmark right at the end of the play. It becomes a territory under Norwegian domination. So what I'm trying to do with those plays is to set up territory figures in Shakespeare's work in different ways. We can see about rivalry over territory. We can see about division of territory, inheritance of territory, inheritance of land, and so on. It pops up in a number of his plays, even when the word doesn't appear. These are the instances where the word appears in Shakespeare, but even in a play where the word doesn't appear, like Hamlet or like Macbeth, I think there's quite a lot going on that should be of interest to people that are interested in territory. In Hamlet and Macbeth, though, I think the sense of territory that we get is actually quite a traditional one of an area of land bounded under a control of a king or under threat from another king who might want to incorporate it into his territories. And that certainly is one sense of the notion of territory, but for me it's a restrictive or a limiting one. What I try to do through the reading of several other plays is to show how Shakespeare opens up different aspects of the question of territory that I think could be interesting to work through. Now, there's only one chapter where I really focus on the linguistic aspect, the use of the word territory. I'm not going to go into detail about it, but it's actually one of the instances in King John where Shakespeare uses the term the territories, and some editors got confused by this because they said there is no sense like this of the use of territories in this way by Shakespeare, and they actually sometimes even suggest amending the text to correct this. It's because if you look at almost all the other instances of territory or territories in Shakespeare, they're all possessions. Your territory, my territory, our territories, his territory. The idea that territory is not a possession but something in itself is actually something that I think is emerging at the time that Shakespeare's writing. And so the territories actually, I think, is a quite an interesting moment. So I do spend some time on the linguistic in there, but that's not the major argument of the book. Most of the book is about the concept and practice of territory rather than the specific. And if it's, I think, again, this is part of the moment that Shakespeare is writing, that if you look at the political theory of the time, if you look at the legal codes, if you look at the debates, the treaties and so on, there's a shift in the way that people are starting to conceptualise and think about the question of territory. In Shakespeare's England, particularly under the Elizabethan period, what England is, its borders, the political rule within it, by Shakespeare's Elizabethan period, is relatively straightforward. People seem to know where it is. There might be debate about who should succeed Elizabeth, or whether there's somebody might want to overthrow Elizabeth to take the crown themselves, or there might be the threat from outside, the Spanish Armada, the relation to the Pope, the relation to European powers. But the borders and the organisation of England is relatively straightforward. By Shakespeare's later plays, when King James of Scotland has become the king, the big territorial question at the time is the newly recreated Britain. So the English and the Scottish crowns coming together, and King James with this project of creating a new Britain. And some of Shakespeare's late plays, King Lear and Cymbeline particularly, talk quite a lot about the question of Britain. But England's recent past and the memory that Shakespeare and his contemporaries would have had will show a space that is far from straightforward. And Shakespeare dramatises that through many of his English history plays. If you look at King John, Richard II, Henry V, two parts of Henry IV and the three parts of Henry VI and so on. So I read some of those history plays to open up some of these different aspects of territory. So I do a reading of Richard II to look at questions of land, questions of banishment, what the relation of a king is to his kingdom. And there's a line where Richard II is criticised for being a landlord of England, not its king. He's using it as the land of the kingdom as something that he can exploit for his own economic purposes to enrich himself, rather than governing as a ruler over the whole kingdom. Let's go on to a reading of the beginning of Henry V. If you know Henry V as a play, the main part of the play is about Henry V trying to conquer France, to lay a claim to the French crown, and then the military conquest over France, the Battle of Agincourt and Harfleur and so on. But the very beginning of the play has a debate between Henry's advisors, particularly religious advisors, about whether he can lay claim to France. And so there's a discussion of what's called the Salic Law, which is about the question of inheritance and where that law applies, whether it is in modern-day France or lands to the east of France. So I try and use Henry V and Edward III as ways of reading legal questions into debates about territory, about possession, about inheritance, about succession, and so on. Now, these kind of economic, legal, strategic questions that I'm reading in the plays up to this point, I think are important and are interesting at Shakespeare's time, but they're relatively long-standing historically. I think you can find economic, legal, strategic questions about territory much further back in history. The particular time that Shakespeare's writing, though, is also the time that many of the European countries are establishing empires overseas or colonies overseas. And so one of the things that I talk about is the way that these territorial issues are playing out in new spaces at the time that Shakespeare's writing. Now, the obvious colonial play of Shakespeare's is The Tempest. And I do talk about The Tempest, but I also focus on what I call the Eastern Mediterranean plays. So Pericles, Antony and Cleopatra, and Othello, because I think there's also colonial relations working in those plays that are interesting. Do you know Othello? Do you know the story in Othello? Othello, the main story that everybody focuses on is Othello, who is a black man who has become powerful military commander in Venice, marries a white woman, Desdemona, and Othello's ensign, Iago, who is so jealous about being passed over for a promotion, creates this plot to deceive Othello that his wife has been unfaithful to him. And Othello, consumed by rage and jealousy, ends up murdering his wife. Now, most people read Othello in terms of that domestic tragedy, of the rivalry between a husband and a wife, the deception of Iago. But right at the beginning of the play, again, as many of Shakespeare's plays, a much broader scene is set. And it actually works in a parallel way. One of the first things Iago does to create this problem for Othello is to wake up Othello's wife, Desdemona's father, in the middle of the night to say, you know, your daughter has been abducted by this black man and she's gone off with him and, you know, wake up, reclaim your daughter. The very next scene has the Venetian council being convened in the middle of the night because Cyprus, a colony of Venice, has been under threat from the Turks, the Ottoman Empire. And this deception is actually going on in both plays, this idea that some valued property, whether it is a daughter or a colony, is under threat by a supposed barbarian other, actually runs in both of these plays at the same time. And there's a confusion about what the Turkish fleet are doing. There's various reports come to the Venetian council. But the very things that they talk about are exactly the same kinds of things that Iago is doing in terms of his deception. So I'm not going to read the whole passage of this, but there's this idea, well, is the Turkish fleet going for Cyprus or is it going for Rhodes, another island in the eastern Mediterranean? But the second and the third line there, 'tis a pageant to keep us in false gaze. It's some kind of performance that might work as a deception. And then later on, about four lines from the bottom there, we must not think the Turk is so unskillful to leave that latest which concerns him first. So a deception by the Turkish fleet, the Ottoman fleet, about whether Cyprus or Rhodes is their target, at the same time that Iago is beginning this deception of Othello, so that Othello thinks that his wife has been unfaithful to him, and that this leads to the other parts of the play. Again, this setting up of a wider world, the colonial relations of Venice, why Othello is such a valued member of Venetian society, because he's made his reputation in the Cyprus Wars, and now he's going to be sent off with a navy of ships to protect Cyprus against the Turks' threat. That wider story, that colonial relations of Venice to the eastern Mediterranean, sets a scene which then most of the play works around the smaller domestic tragedy, the relations around the individual characters. So this is what I do in a number of the readings of the plays, is to set up how there's this wider sort of geographical and I'm suggesting territorial aspect to many of the plays, which then most people tend to focus on the smaller interpersonal character relations. I suppose I should say at this point, many of the most dramatic sort of geographical aspects are often the ones that get cut when these plays get put on stage. Partly because it's very difficult to have an army march across stage or to reenact a naval battle or these kinds of things. But it seems to me that often that misses the way that Shakespeare has set up through language, rather than it having to be dramatic action, this wider world within which a lot of these issues are actually playing out. The last few chapters then look at some other themes. So in chapter 7, I do a reading of a number of different plays to look at what I've called political technologies, which is following Foucault's work, but things like navigation, surveying, cartography, calculative practices like the census, which is about distribution of population across territory, and so on. And it has a particular reading, chapter 7, of a scene in Henry IV, part 1, where three conspirators against the king are plotting how they will divide up England should they overthrow the king. Right? They don't overthrow the king, so this doesn't actually come to pass. But they talk about how a northern power, a Welsh power, and a southern English power will divide up the kingdom if they defeat Henry. And they do this with a map, but they choose rivers as the divide of the kingdom. That the River Severn will divide off Wales from the rest of England, and the River Trent will divide off the north of England from the south of England. And they think that they've made an agreement on this, they're going to seal an agreement, and then they're going to go off and mobilise their armies to overthrow the king. But the northern power, Hotspur, says that he doesn't think that his portion is fair. He doesn't have as much land as the others. And he says this is because of how the river flows. The river, he says, comes me cranking in and cuts me from the best of all my land. The river, for him, flows in the wrong direction. So what he actually proposes is not that they should choose another line on the map or that they should choose another division of the territory. He says that we will have the current of this river dammed up so that it flows in a different direction to make the territorial distribution more equitable. And so what I use this play to do is to say, you know, how important the geophysical landscape is, as well as the geographical, geopolitical sort of imposition over the top of territory and its borders and so on. So it's a way of trying to bring the kind of physical materiality of terrain and landscape into the reading of those plays. And then in chapter 8, through Coriolanus, I try and talk about the relation between territory and bodies, the political body of the community, the political bodies of rulers and leaders. And Coriolanus is a play that has a lot of language about animals, body parts, wounds, contagion, and so on. So I try and use that to sort of think how territory, as well as having obviously a geopolitics, almost has a kind of biopolitics of physical bodies of the kingdom. This is a play set in early Rome. Rome and its neighbours and the body of the state, or the body of the polity, but also the bodies of the rulers and the people that are contesting that rule in there. And then finally, in a chapter called Outside Territory, and particularly looking at forests in Shakespeare, I try and think about something that's today very difficult for us to imagine, but the idea of being outside of territory. today, if you're outside of one territory, in nearly all instances other than, say, the high seas or Antarctica, you're in another territory. Shakespeare's time, there are still places that haven't been enclosed, that haven't been turned into territories, that haven't been ordered and organised through those kind of spatial practices and so on. So I think Shakespeare still at that moment has a sense of what might be outside territory. When somebody goes into banishment, they don't necessarily go immediately into another territory. They may go into the wild, the heath in King Lear, the heath in Macbeth, the forests in these plays. There may be a place outside that's not yet part of another political power's inside. So I try and work that through in a number of plays, but particularly in Titus Andronicus and As You Like It. And then in the last part of the book, The Coda, I talk a bit about nationalism, and particularly that, I said, that shift between the Elizabethan plays where England is the focus to the Jacobean plays where Britain is the focus, this new England and Scotland coming together. But in the main thing I do in the coda of the book is to talk about the notion of a pale. And Shakespeare uses this term in a number of his plays, and he plays on the different meanings. Pale obviously meaning white or a pallor, but pale also as a bounded, enclosed space. Hamlet talks of the pales and forts of reason, Macbeth of the great bond that keeps me pale, sense of fear and of enclosure, sort of within a boundary, but also the fear or the relations within there. And there's all sorts of plays where Shakespeare uses this language. Now, a pale was initially a marked out area of a forest for hunting. It would have a fence and a ditch around it, and the way that the fence and the ditch worked was that deer could jump in, but they couldn't jump back out. So it was a way of enclosing deer so that the king and whoever could go hunting, and they would always find deer in this enclosed and marked out place. The term pale comes from the stakes that we use to form the fences or the boundary around these. It comes from the Latin palus, which is the root of our modern word palisade, but they're a stake or a fence post there. So they're an enclosed, bounded space. And a generation after Shakespeare, the Levellers, the political movement, were named because they were the people that knocked down these pales, these barriers that were increasingly being used to enclose the commons into private farming land or agricultural land. The political sense of the term pale comes from that hunting sense. So an enclosed or bounded space for hunting becomes an enclosed or bounded space for political jurisdiction. And the two most famous pales were the English Pale in Ireland and the Pale of Calais. So the Pale of Calais was a small area around the town Calais that was claimed in the Hundred Years' War by England. This is in the 14th century, and was only lost by England in the 16th century, just a couple of years before Shakespeare was born. So it was an area that the English controlled, a sort of foothold on the European continent. The Pale of Ireland was another area that was held by the English that was centred on Dublin. If you go today, you can still see some of the markings where the old Pale of Ireland was. And the Pale of Ireland was, within the Pale, was English jurisdiction. Beyond or outside the Pale was not English jurisdiction. It might still have been under English control, but it wasn't under English law. And the English Pale actually appears in some of the plays around this time. It appears in Christopher Marlowe's Edward II and in a pirate version of Shakespeare's Henry VI Part II. With troops of Irish kerns that uncontrolled doth plant themselves within the English Pale. Now, a pale, then, in that sense, is clearly an area of space that is under a particular political legal control, an area of jurisdiction. It's clearly a territory. And the common phrase, beyond the pale, which we now use today to mean a number of things, actually comes from that sense, beyond the pale being outside of English jurisdiction in Ireland. Today, the idiomatic sense of beyond the pale means kind of outside of moral laws or outside of judgment or outside of acceptable behaviour. So a pale is certainly a territory, but my suggestion is that not all territories are pale, that a pale is a restrictive way of defining this sense of territory. It's certainly one sense, but what I try and show through all these other chapters is that actually territory encompasses a much broader and wider set of spatial relations, spatial practices, and so on. So building on the work I did in the previous books on territory, I try and show how territory is not simply a pale. And while I do focus on every instance where Shakespeare does use the word territory or territories, as I've suggested, it's a reading that tries to go beyond simply the word and to look at the concept and the practice. And that relation between the word territory, the concept territory, and the practice of territory is one I've tried to work through, in particularly in The Birth of Territory. That there are texts that don't use the word that are clearly speaking about what we now think of as territory, and there are texts that use particularly the Latin territorium that don't quite mean the same as the way we understand that. So that relation between word, concept, and practice is something I've tried to think about before. And really what I try and show in this book is so many of Shakespeare's plays have moments, at least, where they're talking about exile, banishment, land politics, spatial division, contestation, conquest, succession. He's writing at this moment in political thought where the term is starting to take on its modern meaning and being used more frequently. States at his time of pursuing territorial accumulation, territorial surveying, assessment, mapping. And Shakespeare having an eye both to the historical past, the English histories, the Roman histories, but also a sense of where things are going, that shift from England to Britain, the relation to the debates that are going on at his time. Shakespeare helps us to understand that kind of moment of transition. And Shakespeare's plays then open up many of these aspects of territory that I've talked about before, the economic, the legal, the technical, the strategic, but it also talk about some of the things that I neglected in previous work and that some people who've critically engaged with my writings have pointed out, that I don't talk about the colonial, that I don't talk about the corporeal, that I have not talked so much about the geophysical. So Shakespeare becomes a way for me to kind of push that way of thinking about territory more broadly than I had done in previous work. So territory, I think, in Shakespeare becomes this ever wider set of concerns that I hope it opens up and unpacks some of those broader issues. And that's why I end the book by saying that we need to think territory beyond the pale. We need to think territory beyond that restrictive sense of simply a bounded space and actually open up those broader set of spatial practices and understandings.